The show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. When Gustav Eiffel introduced his idea for a 1,000-foot metal tower in the middle of Paris, it was met with disgust and ridicule. Parisians called it scaffolding, an eyesore, and structurally impossible. The Eiffel Tower was the centerpiece of the 1889 World's Fair, but not its only star. Artists, inventors, and newsmen make up the cast of characters in a new book about the tower and the great exposition where it came to the world's attention. The book is titled Eiffel's Tower, and its author, Jill Jones, joins me in the studio. I look forward to hearing your questions and comments this morning. I'm sure many of you have visited Paris, seen the Eiffel Tower, have your own comments and thoughts. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Jill. It's good to have you here.
Delighted to be here.
I gather that you say this was the most fun book you've ever written. How come?
Well, because it has an incredible cast of characters. It's set in Paris in the Belle Epoque. And not only do you have Gustave Eiffel, you have Buffalo Bill and Annie Oakley. You have Thomas Edison. You have all kinds of wonderful artists. James McNeill Whistler, who is really, we think of him as someone who painted a dour portrait of his mother, but he was an enfant terrible who loved to have feuds and fisticuffs. And then there was Gauguin, who was really an unknown. There was Rosa Bonheur, who was unknown to me, but was enormously famous in part because she wore pants, for which she was required to get an official permit. So it's just a very delicious story.
You know, I have been to Paris several times, but I've never thought about the Eiffel Tower as being Eiffel. I mean, it was just a name. How did you think about it?
Very much the same way. I spent several years in Paris as a girl. I've been there many times because my father worked overseas. And I completely took it for granted. So I, too, just always thought, oh, the Eiffel Tower, and I mean, I have to say, it shows a certain lack of curiosity.
On both our parts. Until what happened?
Well, a few years ago, I read two books by Ross King, which I really loved, Brunelleschi's Dome and Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling. And I found these to be enormously charming books, and I thought, surely there's a monument out there that I, too, could write about. And it was as obvious as this. It was Eiffel's Tower.
Tell us about Gustave Eiffel.
So Gustave Eiffel was very much a child of the bourgeoisie. He was born and raised in Dijon. It was his expectation that he would run his uncle's vinegar factory. And to that end, he went to Paris to the École Polytechnique and studied chemistry. However, his uncle had a tremendous political falling out with Gustave's parents. And so the dream of running the vinegar factory came to an end. And Eiffel found himself working in what was really the great industrial revolution of his time, which was the railroad industry. And he then discovered he had a great genius for building railroad bridges. And that led to a global empire. He had offices in Peru, Shanghai, Singapore. And he had developed mathematical formulas for building these very complex, very beautiful arched railway bridges. And overseas, what he was designing and sending out were modular bridges and buildings that could be accommodated to all kinds of different circumstances. And so that is how, in 1884, when the French Republic decided it wanted to celebrate the centennial of the downfall of Bastille, he was the person who stepped forward, proposing this very spectacular centerpiece, a 1,000-foot tower in iron, for the exposition, the World's Fair of 1889.
From whom did he have to receive permission to build this 1,000-foot tower?
Well, of course, it was the French government, and they were looking for something very spectacular that would express the fact that the Third Republic viewed itself as really a very progressive force, something on the that they were embracing technology and science, and that all of this was to the greater glory of the ordinary man. And the idea of making a 1,000-foot tower had actually first been proposed by the British and the Americans, but they had never pulled it off. And so that was the other aspect of this that was very enchanting to the French. They were going to do what the Americans had said they would do, and it would be the French who would build the 1,000-foot tower, which would be the tallest structure in the world.
Now, was there a drawing of the tower published prior to his beginning to create this, what some called a monstrosity, others viewed as absolutely glorious?
Well, there was actually a contest. And so there were many entries, including one which I think it's a great shame that it was never built as a perhaps ancillary monument, which was a working model, a gigantic working model of a guillotine.
Whoa!
I think for political reasons, the French thought this was a bad reminder
of past
problems.
Yeah.
But so Eiffel did submit this drawing. And
do you know how many submissions there were?
Hundreds.
Hundreds.
But the truth is that the contest was really rigged because the rules called for a tower made of metal and it would be a certain height. And really, the truth was that Eiffel was the only person who could produce this.
I see.
So
and the judges knew this before?
Well, it was the government.
Okay.
And they basically knew what they wanted. They had seen what he had drawn, and then they devised the rules so that he would win.
Okay. So then was a drawing of his proposed structure published in the newspaper?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So people saw it beforehand?
Yes.
And what was the reaction?
Well, I think, it wasn't quite clear for a while whether Eiffel would pull this off because it took him he won the contest, but it took him a long time to actually get the contract. It was because there was so much opposition. And so I think the opponents thought initially that they would manage to nip it in the bud. But in the end, it was really the only spectacular centerpiece that was offered. And furthermore, Eiffel, because he was so wealthy, could pay for almost two-thirds of it himself. It cost 5 million francs, and the government only gave him 1.5 million. He provided the rest of the money, and the agreement was that he would be allowed to keep the tower up for 20 years to recoup his investment. So when it became clear that the tower was going to go up, I mean, he was actually building it starting in January of 1887, then the elite and intellectuals of Paris rose in a fury and wrote this letter, and I'll just read a little bit of it. They denounced the tower as this horror, a black and gigantic factory chimney crushing all Paris beneath its barbarous mass. And this is the part I really love. Even commercial America would not have this.
Even commercial America. I love it.
But the great thing about Eiffel is he just gave back as good as he got. And he said, this tower will have its own beauty. It will show we are not simply an amusing people.
Didn't he also say, he stated that his goal was to demonstrate to the whole world that France is a great country, that she still is capable of success where others have failed.
Yes, this was very much about a rivalry between France and the United States because the United States had become such an important power and was so technologically on the cutting edge. And so the French really wanted to show, and especially someone like Eiffel, who was an engineer, that the French were as capable and as inventive as any other people.
Jewel Jones, her new book is titled Eiffel's Tower and the World's Fair, where Buffalo Bill beguiled Paris, the artist quarreled, and Thomas Edison became a count. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. How long did it actually take for the tower to be completed from beginning to end?
Well, so construction began on January 28th of 1887, and the tower opened 120 years from tomorrow on May 15th at 11:50 a.m., 1 week after, I should say, the fair opened. So it did open a week late.
Now, was there a charge to proceed into the tower?
Yes, and that depended on how far up you went. Each level cost more. But I should say that that not only was the tower an enormous success in terms of aesthetics. I mean, as the tower rose in the Paris skyline, all of Eiffel's critics, with the exception of Guy de Maupassant, really ate their words and acknowledged how beautiful and graceful it was, and really what a symbol of modernity and how unique and original it was. But it was also a financial success, and by the end of the summer, Eiffel had recouped all of his investment.
I was going to ask you, so his notion of holding on to it, taking possession for 20 years, probably made him a millionaire, many
even richer.
Times.
Yes. Well, there were stockholders, and so they all did very well also, but certainly Eiffel did very well.
Isn't that an incredible story? And if you'd like to join us after the break, call us on 800-433-8850 as we talk about Jill Jones' new book, Eiffel's Tower.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next at 11.
I'm Jim Lehrer of the NewsHour, and I'm here to congratulate my dear friend and esteemed colleague Diane Rehm on her 30 years in broadcasting. My wife Kate and I have been guests of Diane's many times, and we are always amazed at the breadth of her knowledge, care for her listeners, and ability to handle any subject. Diane, congratulations on your most remarkable achievement.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Nandi Show, the impact of actions and words. First, a literary activist reflects on life at 60 and helps us measure success by the lives we affect. Then, dealing with workplace bullies, what new research says about bullying's effect on co-worker health, morale, and productivity. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
71 degrees in Northwest Washington. It's 10:20.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
I'm looking at a photograph of the Eiffel Tower ablaze with light. I gather, Jill Jones, that photograph was taken during the 1889 fair.
Yes, from the very beginning, everyone understood the wondrousness of seeing this very tall structure lit up at night. And also, it really enhanced the gracefulness of it. And it was a great launching pad for pyrotechnics. So people, from the very beginning, everyone's always done all kinds of wonderful things, combining lighting and the Eiffel Tower.
You've talked about the rave reviews that Gustav Eiffel received, with the exception of one. What about from the American side? There had to have been many American architectural critics who came to see it. What did they say?
Well, the Americans were very churlish from the beginning.
I'll bet.
Because what I haven't mentioned is the building that had been the tallest building in the world and that was eclipsed by the Eiffel Tower was the Washington Monument.
Of course.
555 feet tall, and it had only been finished in 1984, and so it hadn't been the tallest. 1884. So it hadn't been the tallest building for almost any time at all before it was superseded by the Eiffel Tower. And so the Americans were very snippish. And the other thing is that from the minute the Eiffel Tower was finished, they were always talking about how they, the Americans, we, would be building a tower that was at least 2,000 feet tall. Just a matter of time.
And how long did it take?
Well, there was not a structure in the world that was taller than the Eiffel Tower until 1929 when the Chrysler Building was built. And that was only taller by 29 feet.
Huh. Well, the photograph here is so wondrous. How was the lighting achieved?
Well, actually, by gas lights, by and large. And then there were some electric lights. The fair itself was lit up with electricity of the sort generated by Edison plants. And one of the really wonderful things about this whole story is that the fair itself is really a stage for all kinds of ambitious people. And one of those was Edison. And he did not tell anyone that he was planning to come. There was a huge gallery of machines, 15 acres of technological advance, and 1 acre of that was Edison's exhibit. And what was extraordinary about it is this is where most people first encountered recorded sound. So Edison had improved his talking phonograph to the point that he really could record anything on his wax cylinders. And people waited in line for hours, 15,000 people a day.
Oh,
he had 50
wow.
machines. Each of them had five, and it's very odd, iPod-like connections to them when you see the photos. And people were limited to 3 minutes, and they would hear singing or famous people giving speeches. There were many different languages, so you could choose a language that you would understand. And this was really like a miracle. And so all of a sudden, towards the end of the fair in August, unannounced, Edison shows up with his wife and a whole entourage and says, "I've come to see the Eiffel Tower like everyone else." And the French are beside themselves with really joy because this is such a credit to their fair.
Of course.
That Edison, who had never been to Europe in his life, has come to see the Eiffel Tower. In truth, of course, he's there to promote his phonograph. And everywhere he goes, every night he's having a banquet. And one of the other delights of this book is all the eating and all the menus and all the champagne and wine and so forth. And everywhere Edison went, he took his phonograph.
Don't you wish you could have been there?
I really do. I've very rarely in my life ever had a feeling like, oh, I just wish I could have time traveled back. But in this fair, you really do have that feeling because it was such a sensational, just visually it was sensational, and the range of things that went on. So the fair itself was very beautiful. You had the Eiffel Tower. You had all these very fanciful, whimsical buildings that were sheathed in this very shimmery, intensely colored faience tiles. And every country that came really went out of its way to make a really extraordinary building. And then there were statues everywhere. There were fountains, you know, shooting up with all kinds of water and outdoor orchestras. The landscaping was spectacular. So just it was very delightful to experience. And then the marvels to be seen. There was everything from at the Pavilion of the Equator, you could see a shrunken head the size of a walnut. Then you could go to a Javanese village where Javanese dancers were performing.
Did the United States have an exhibit?
They did, but everyone was very embarrassed by it. It was apparently, and that was why they were so glad that Edison had done this spectacular exhibit, because that was his own personal private exhibit. But the public exhibit done by the United States was universally agreed to be an embarrassment.
What was it?
Well, you know, it was a few things like jewelry and it was of so little consequence. I've
wow.
expended no time on it.
Wow.
The other thing that saved the Americans and gave them enormous pride, of course, was the arrival of Buffalo Bill and the Wild West Show.
And Annie Oakley.
With Annie Oakley. And Annie Oakley was an astonishment to the French. Remember, this is an era when Many people have been in the military, and many people hunt. And so there's a real understanding of what it means to be a crack shot and a sharpshooter. But Annie Oakley looks like she's about, 20 years old. She's actually 29. And she's a very small, petite, very adorable woman. And out she comes into this arena, charging around on her pony, and she can shoot a hole through a 10-centime piece that has been tossed in the air. The French couldn't believe their eyes. So she was a great sensation, and I always love this. Sadi Carnot, who is president of France, said to her, "If you feel a need to change your nationality and occupation, there is a commission awaiting you in the French army."
Oh, I love it. I love it. You know, I want to go back to the tower for a moment because you said that Gustave Eiffel had had all this experience building these railroad bridges with curves, and so he was probably the only person who could have constructed this. But surely he faced some challenges in the construction process itself.
The big challenge, so the way the Eiffel Tower was built was very much like a big 3D puzzle. And it was all of the pieces were designed and manufactured out in his factories according to these algorithms that he had devised. And each piece weighed about 3 tons. And they were partially assembled when they were brought to the site of the Eiffel Tower, which is, of course, right next to the Seine River. And they were then assembled with 2,500,000 rivets. And that's essentially what the building of the tower was all about, was these teams of welders putting all these big bolts in and then welding them together
on
both ends.
And who were they?
Well, these were just regular iron workers. Some of them had worked for Eiffel before on some of his bridges. Those were probably the core crews. But otherwise, he simply hired people and trained them. And
I would think the height might have proved an obstacle for workers never used to working at those kinds of heights.
Well, that didn't seem to be the case.
Huh.
I mean, the workers tried to use that as a reason to be paid more, that as the tower rose up and got taller and taller. And Eiffel actually did concede to that, though he said if you thought about it, if you were going to fall and die, it didn't matter whether you did it at 800 feet or 400 feet. The biggest issue they had was making sure when they got to the first floor platform, that it was absolutely level. Because if it was not level, then the whole rest of the tower would not be straight. And that, of course, would eventually be a disaster. And so they spent a great deal of time very carefully. They had this very ingenious system where they could jack up. There were 4 feet, obviously, and each foot had a corner. And under each of those corners was a system of jacks that allowed them, with great finesse to get this first platform level. And once they did that, really, it was just a matter of moving up and getting everything, done in time. Now, the other great difficulty actually was the elevators, which, of course, Eiffel himself couldn't build. But he had to make sure that everything moved properly within his structure.
Has there, since 1889, when it was built, had there been any kinds of difficulties or shiftings or movements or any kind of buckling?
Well, let me put it like this. If there has, I don't think anyone's been told about it. But I don't think so.
Isn't that absolutely extraordinary?
It is extraordinary.
When you think about this gorgeous tower on the cover of your book, totally lit up, columns and columns of light bulbs, small light bulbs. And then like a cake layer at the bottom. It's really just so beautiful.
It is beautiful, and it's completely original, and it has retained its power to this day. I mean, that's one of the things that's so interesting about the tower, is that we still think of it as very modern. It's an icon of modernity, and it's tremendously glamorous. And those aspects of it, I think, have only increased with time. I began to realize as I worked on this book that I think you could safely say that the Eiffel Tower is the most famous structure in the world, the most instantly recognizable and known to people. And I began to realize that I saw it every single day, this image, someplace in some way. It could be as simple as I'm driving down the street and there's Paris dry cleaners. Well, there's the Eiffel Tower on the awning. Or it's that you walk into a bookstore and almost invariably there will be an Eiffel Tower somewhere on some book cover. And again, it's what is that saying to you? It's talking about glamour. It's talking about France. It's the symbol of France and of Paris.
And, of course, some might argue that the pyramids would be equally as famous and equally as daunting and certainly mysterious in their structure and in their class as you look at them.
This I would agree, with the exception that I don't think that they get I don't think that you see the image of the pyramid anywhere as often as you do that of the Eiffel Tower. I mean, that was just what struck me.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones. I know many of you have questions for Jill Jones on her new book, Eiffel's Tower. Let's go first to East Lansing, Michigan. Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Diane. I want to thank you for your show. You're really a national treasure.
Oh, thank you.
I first listened to you in 87 when my nephew was 7 months old, and I took care of him, and during his nap, I'd listen to your show.
Oh, that's terrific.
He graduated from college last week. So
congratulations. That's wonderful.
I had a question when I called, but the pyramid versus Eiffel Tower distinction has me fascinated, so I just want to make two comments, and they each have a question with
them. Sure.
Carol Zaleski taught a course about cathedrals as the center of social and economic life in Europe during the Middle Ages, and Stephen Jay Gould, my other professor, talked about how they were built and they'd collapse on the prisoners, and they never knew how to build them, and they killed literally thousands of prisoners when the structure would fall. And so that was the basis for my two comments. My first comment was, isn't the Eiffel Tower a symbol just like the Empire State Building or the Sears Tower and the World Trade Center of this new capitalist economy? Isn't that the center of our economic, social, and cultural life? And my second comment was, isn't it sacred in the way that the market and the capitalist economy is sacred? My sister got this mysterious proposal to go to Paris, where she speaks French and she's a Francophile, and her husband proposed to her on the Eiffel Tower. And it seems to me that we endow these buildings with this sacred significance.
Well, yes, I agree that the whole point of the Eiffel Tower was to be a symbol of the modern and of industrial progress. It was a monument to industrialism. Well, I think that's very charming that your sister was proposed to on the Eiffel Tower.
I think there are lots of people who perhaps can point to that moment and that place as the spot where a proposal took place. But his point is, isn't there a certain sacred element?
Yes, I think that's true. One of the things about the Eiffel Tower that is unique is the way you experience it. I mean, first of all, when you arrive, no one is ever prepared for how gargantuan it is. The size and scale of it are humbling. And yet there's a very playful joie de vivre aspect of the Eiffel Tower, which is that it's open. And so as you go up into it, you're really communing with the elements. It's this combination of man-made industrial glory and whatever is happening with the weather. And there is always a playfulness and a delight on the tower. And at the same time, really, as you get higher and higher, this connection with how tiny the universe seems to be below you, that the man-made universe begins to sort of melt away the further up you rise.
Have you gone all the way up?
I have, and I have something of a fear of heights.
I cannot do it for exactly that reason. But how did you react?
Well, the world does feel very tiny, and you really are up in the winds up there.
Exactly. And how open is it up there?
It's not that open, but, I mean, I never want to get too close to the edges of these places, so I'm not peering over the side. Eiffel actually had, and there still is, an apartment up on the very top of the Eiffel Tower. And when Edison came, Eiffel entertained him there. There was a piano, and Gounod, who was the composer of Faust, came and serenaded them.
How in the world did they get a piano into the Eiffel Tower?
You know, I have to admit, I wondered about that. I wondered if they took it apart and reassembled it or what.
Yeah.
But all summer long, Eiffel held court on the very top of the Eiffel Tower. All the royals from all over the world came, actresses, Buffalo Bill, Annie Oakley.
Wish I had been there, Jill Jones. And the book is titled Eiffel's Tower.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up at 11.
My name is Mark Redler, a longtime NPR listener, and I enjoy Morning Edition very much. There's one year-long series you're doing now on climate change I think is not only really informative, but I really like the fact that parts of that series are being carried on Morning Edition because that's the time of day I listen. Morning Edition is my source for not just information, but for a great way to start my day.
That's Morning Edition, every weekday morning from 5 to 10 on WAMU 88.5.
Filmmaker Davis Guggenheim loves the guitar.
You know, we don't worship the flute or the piano. We have them, we listen to them, they're nice. But the next generation will always pick up on that raw sexuality of that instrument.
His documentary features Jimmy Page, Jack White, and The Edge. It Might Get Loud, next time on Bob Edwards Weekend from PRI, Public Radio International.
And that's today at 2 on WAMU 88.5. Tonight at 6, we'll celebrate the life of the father of bluegrass, Bill Monroe. In honor of his 98th birthday, several bluegrass country hosts, including Dick Spotswood, Katie Daly, and Hubie King, present reflections on the man and his music. That's a celebration of the father of bluegrass, Bill Monroe, tonight at 6 on WAMU 88.5. Complete schedules are at WAMU.org.
Come on down the mountain, Katie Daly.
Good morning, I'm Katie Daly, and I'm here for the next 3 hours.
WAMU's bluegrass country host Katie Daly started her radio career in 1972. Katie's outstanding work on the air and in the community has garnered her a second nomination for Bluegrass Broadcaster of the Year.
I was very surprised, a very moving experience.
Good luck, Katie. And thanks to our listeners for making WAMU's Bluegrass Country the world's leading source for bluegrass and Americana music.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Clearly, many of you have thoughts and memories about the Eiffel Tower. Let's go now to David in Detroit, Michigan. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane Rehm.
Hi.
I just had an interesting fact that I have somehow collected, and I'm actually not quite sure if it's a fact, but this is the perfect time to find out for sure. My question is, I had heard that there's always this competition between France and America, and the previous World's Fair in America, the big thing was the American Ferris wheel, and as part of the competition, they wanted to beat this Ferris wheel, which I don't really think of as being on the same scale as the Eiffel Tower, but the Eiffel Tower was constructed to beat the American's Ferris wheel. Is that true, or is that just something that was fabricated?
Well, it's reversed. So the Eiffel Tower was first, and then at the White...
1889.
And then at the White City in 1893, they were desperately looking something that would, you know, outdo the Eiffel Tower. And the Ferris wheel was devised, I'm not sure the man's first name, but his last name was Ferris. And he invented the Ferris wheel, which was, you know, very delightful and huge and impressive. But I think we can all agree the Ferris wheel is not the Eiffel Tower.
Now, didn't Gustav Eiffel offer to construct something for that 1893 World's Fair?
Yes. So Eiffel knew that they were wanting to out-Eiffel Eiffel, and he proposed himself that he would build a taller tower for them. But the American engineers were outraged at that idea, and they said, no, this is our fair. An American will come up with something better than you.
David, I hope that clears it up for you.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Here's an email from Linda in Prospect, Kentucky. She says, my friend tells the story of her great-grandfather, who was a worker on the tower. He was involved in an accident and fell from quite a high height. Luckily, his fall was broken by a tree. Being delighted he was still alive, he immediately went to a bar and got drunk. His family, in the meantime, had been told he was killed by the fall and were mourning his death. Imagine the scene when he returned home the next morning.
See, you hear these stories and you think, oh, I wish I knew that when I was writing my book.
Here's another. He says, this is from Nikki in Louisville, Kentucky, who says, my favorite story about the Eiffel Tower is one I heard a few years ago about a reporter who went to interview an older Frenchman who had been standing on the observation platform of the tower nearly every day for several years. The reporter approached the old man and asked him what he loved so much about the tower that he would make the trip daily. The old man replied he hated the Eiffel Tower, but this was, quote, the only place in all of Paris where you can't see the damn thing. Now, you've got a quote there.
Yes. Well, so the one person who never recanted about his hatred of the tower was the writer Guy de Maupassant. And in his travel memoir, he wrote this. I left Paris and even France because the Eiffel Tower just annoyed me too much. Not only did you see it from everywhere, you found it everywhere, made out of every known material, displayed in all the shop windows, an unavoidable and horrible nightmare. And what de Maupassant wondered, he said, what would people think of his generation if, in some future riot, we do not unbolt this tall, skinny pyramid of iron ladders, this giant and disgraceful skeleton with a base that seems made to support a formidable monument of Cyclops and which aborts into the thin, ridiculous profile of a factory chimney.
Oh, my. The anger that's seething through those words. Let's go now to Noblesville, Indiana. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, young lady. I'm a longtime listener.
Well, thank you, sir.
I live out here on a farm in Indiana. I'm a retired Air Force pilot.
I was
flying the A-26 attack bomber during World War II, stationed up in northeastern France after the war. I put my gunner up in the front with me. We flew down to Paris, and I knew the Eiffel Tower was down there, and I flew pylons around the Eiffel Tower, and Eisenhower was unhappy with all of those pilots buzzing Paris, and they put P-51s up there trying to catch us doing that. They were military MPs in the air.
Woo!
I flew back to my base up in northeastern France and told the other pilots what I did, and some other pilots went down to fly pylons around the Eiffel Tower. I'm a long-time listener, and I've been listening to you forever almost.
Oh, Richard. Well, that's lovely. I want to know whether you ever got officially reprimanded for what
you did.
Negative.
Some of the pilots got caught and they were fine, but I never got caught. Eisenhower didn't like us doing that.
Well, I'll bet he didn't. Well, that must have been quite an experience.
Well, you know, one of the most poignant stories attached to the Eiffel Tower has to do with World War II, because, of course, it was the symbol of Paris.
Sure.
And the Nazi flag flew on it. So as soon as the French saw that the Nazis were in retreat, and some of them, of course, anticipated this, that, you know, the war was in its final days, they had made homemade French flags out of dyed sheets. And this one particular Frenchman who was a fireman, he began his way up the tower, and he looked up and he realized there were people ahead of him. Other people had this same idea.
Huh.
And as they were going up the tower, they were getting riddled with bullets from the Germans, who were in retreat, but they understood exactly what was about to happen. And of course, what did happen is that first crew got up there and they put the French tricolor up, you know, on the top of the Eiffel Tower, which said to all of Paris, the war is over.
Mm.
Beautiful story.
What a symbol. Let's go to Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning, Anne.
Hello.
Hi.
First of all, I think it's kind of fun, given the recent news that Mr. Eiffel came from Dijon. But my question is about a Hungarian designer who apparently submitted a candidate for this exposition's centerpiece. His was not accepted. Does Jill Jones know anything about his attempt to produce something for man-made industrial glory? What he did, of course, is he went on to, as I understand it, to design and build the fabulous Great Market in Budapest.
No, I do not. I'm sorry.
That's not a story that you've heard. Thanks for calling, Anne. Let's go now to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Steve.
Hi.
Hi.
I worked for Otis Elevator, and we had always heard that the French could not figure out how to put an elevator in the thing, and they had to call Otis in to do that for them from America. Do you know anything about that?
This is completely true, but they didn't actually have to bring them from America because Otis had an office in Paris. And from the time that Eiffel was announced as the winner, though, of course, the stipulation was he could only employ French firms. So the Otis firm just sat there and began planning how they were going to build an elevator that would go from the ground floor to the second floor, which is a curved leg, and that was the challenge. No French elevator firm stepped forward to fill this contract, and so finally Eiffel had no choice but to give this contract to Otis Elevator.
Oh, I see. So there was no French firm that could have done this.
This was a great consolation to the Americans as they were being very churlish about the tower being, it's like, we put the elevator into the second floor.
I hope that answers it, Steve. Here's an email, don't know whether this is myth, from Danny, who's in Little Rock, Arkansas. He says, I lived in New Orleans in the 80s, and while I was there, someone brought a part of the Eiffel Tower to become a restaurant on St. Charles Avenue. I always wondered why a part of such a landmark would be removed and shipped to Louisiana.
Well, when he says a part, what kind of a part?
one has to wonder.
I mean, it could have been part of a restaurant on the Eiffel Tower that got disassembled.
Did he build anything else that we know about?
You mean of this sort, beyond bridges?
Yeah.
Well, he did build buildings. I mean, in fact, the train station in Pest, which I guess is Budapest, though, he built that, and that's actually quite a famous structure, a combination of metalwork and stone. He did the inside of the Statue of Liberty. The Statue of Liberty would not exist if Gustav Eiffel had not solved the problem of the interior structure.
What was it about?
It was the skeleton. I mean, so the Statue of Liberty is very tall and very heavy, and so it required interior supports, and this was all very complicated. And Bartholdi was a sculptor. I mean, he was not an engineer. And so the interior engineering was done by Eiffel.
You know, I don't think I knew that at all. Is that terribly well known?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, we think of the Eiffel Tower as
Bertoldi.
A statue.
Yeah.
Right, Bertoldi, yes. And
Isn't that interesting? Bertoldi
was one of the many who was entertained by Eiffel on top of the tower.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's go to Muncie, Indiana. Hi there, Robert.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
My story is that when I was in 1963, I was in college, and we went to went to Europe and got off the plane. I'm a ministerial student then, by the way, and we went from the plane straight to the Eiffel Tower, went up, and we never had time to take a break. So when we got to the top and had some time, I went to the men's room, and there was a chambermaid there. Nobody had ever explained to me about chambermaids, and my mother told me, you know, if you're in a men's room and a woman comes in, you don't talk to her. So I ignored her and got out of there as quick as I could, and then she chased me around the top of the Eiffel Tower until finally I gave her a tip. So that was my introduction to French culture.
That's quite a story, Robert. Thanks for joining us this morning. And let's see here to Euless, Texas at 7 minutes before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Go ahead, Euless, you're on the air.
Thanks, Diane. Great to talk to you.
Thanks.
In 1968, I was 12 years old. My family spent 6 months in a VW camper bus going all around the continent. We spent a week in Paris just at the time when the students were having their demonstrations on the left bank. So we went up in the tower, had a marvelous, expensive, overpriced lunch, and we're walking the lower promenade when we saw about 40 buses pull up, about 200 gendarmes, and a riot ensued below us. So we overviewed the beauty of Paris, whiffing tear gas. And I guess the students were looking to place a flag on the Eiffel Tower as the high ground and the symbol of their... they never made it, but it was a fascinating day. Watching French politics and looking over the city. Just wanted to share that. And have a great day.
Thanks for calling. Here's an email from Robert in Rural Hall, North Carolina. He says, I had always imagined the Eiffel Tower as black until I went to Paris in the 1990s. I was surprised to see it painted beige. Has it always been beige, or was this an attempt to blend it in to the surrounding sandstone buildings?
Well, originally it was painted a sort of a bronze red, and of course this became an enormously fashionable color. It was known as Eiffel Red. And as the tower got taller, it became more and more yellow. So actually, it starts out, this is in 1889, it started off quite red and got progressively lighter as it got to the top.
Why did it get progressively lighter? Had he planned it that way? He wanted it painted that way?
Yeah, everything about the Eiffel Tower was very much under Eiffel's instructions.
So it started out red, and gosh, I wish we had a color photograph of that.
Well, actually, we do, though I have to say it's not in my book. There are some very beautiful color photographs, and I'm almost guessing in this day and age, if you looked enough on Google, you would find them, and they're quite distinctive because there's sort of a handful of them.
And then how did the color evolve over time?
You know, to be honest, I don't know all the intervening colors that it has been, but I think it's been, you know, darker sort of grays. And,
yeah, I remember it as gray last time I saw it. How long has it been beige?
You know, I really don't know. To be honest, my knowledge of the Eiffel Tower is very good for the 1889.
Yeah, I understand.
Gets up to about World War II, and that's it.
And final question from a listener, Mark, who says, how and why did public perception go from ridicule and an eyesore to beauty and a world-recognized masterpiece?
It happened very quickly, and essentially once the tower began to rise and you could see it in the sky, people could see with their own eyes how incredibly graceful it was. And the fact that when you went below it, it was so gargantuan. There was something so dramatic about the fact that something that you experienced underneath was so huge. And then as you went away from it, it became so graceful that the contrast between these two perceptions, you know, firsthand, really struck people. And it really was world famous by the time it was finished. And it was replicated from the very start in every single kind of material you can imagine. And this was true all over the world. So it's truly served its purpose, which was to draw people to the fair. The 30 million people came to the fair from all over the world. I mean, you could go to the Eiffel Tower and there would be 20 different nationalities there.
Jill Jones, her new book with this glorious structure on the cover is titled Eiffel's Tower. Thank you for the work you've done. It was just fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Good morning. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5. I'm Janine Herbst.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Ascendio.
And I'm General Manager Karen Mathis.
Raising a child is always a challenge, but for parents who care for children with special needs, those challenges can be overwhelming.
Easter Seals of Greater Washington, Baltimore Region helps ensure that people with disabilities or special needs and their families have equal opportunities to live, learn, work, and play in their communities.
Services and resources at Easter Seals include senior and adult day services, child development centers, therapy, and respite centers.
United Cerebral Palsy of Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia seeks to advance the